welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who still confuses Hard Rain, Rain Man, Singing in the Rain, Purple Rain, Black Rain. However, he mixes them up with Rain of Fire, Rain Over Me, and this has led to some very confusing moments for you, hasn't it? And it's left crowds of people confused, because you were trying to explain it to people, and then they were trying to explain it to you. No, it's like, it's rain. Yeah, rain. No, Rain Over Me. Yeah, so like Rain Man. No, like Rain of Fire. Yeah, it's raining fire. No, it's not like fire that's on rain. It's a rain. Like a king reigns. Wait, what do kings reign? Well, over countries. Oh yeah, rains on countries. And then you're like, no, but like Singing in the Rain. So it's like a dictator who's raining and he's singing. And then they're like, no,
dragon is breathing fire on him.
Yeah, and then they're saying Hard Rain. Yeah, so it's like a guy who's like really tough and he's raining over people. And then like Rain Man, you're like, it's the same thing as the Madness of King George. And people are like, no, what? And then you're like, yeah, but Purple Rain is like Chubby Rain. And the fact that the rain coming down is chubby or purple. But Black Rain is about Michael Douglas in the rain. And then people just get really confused. And then you get groups of people who come in to like unconfuse those people. And you went to a UF Miami game once, basketball game, and you confused the entire arena. It like spread like the 28 days later rage virus. By the end of the game, everyone was so confused that they just stopped cheering for the teams.
I didn't even know.
It's John Levingood, everybody.
Well, thank you, Mark. So it's like, if I'm referring to Black Rain and I'm like, man, I can't believe that they had to defend themselves against something so big and strong. And they're like, oh, you mean the dragon? Like, no, Michael Douglas's chin.
And then they're like,
jaw.
Wait, the dragon was Michael Douglas's chin?
I don't know. And so Christian Slater was riding a wave runner away from an explosion because a dragon had breathed fire through that high school hallway.
Oh, that would still be boring.
If there were dragons breathing fire?
No, because all I could do is go straight down a hallway.
I suppose that's true.
Like, make a clumsy turn.
Black Rain, Rain of Fire. Wasn't there also a TV show called Rain? Something about royalty?
Yeah, it was just called Rain.
I just imagine it's about the cinder falling from the sky after the dragon burned down all those huts.
I just thought it was about Rain. The Rain Man, he was actually a dictator.
I thought Rain Man was a dragon.
Rain Man was about Pol Pot.
Lord. You know, it's kind of funny, by the way. I was reflecting on our show recently. We've discussed it a little bit. I'll bet that people listening are wondering, like, if they just joined us in the last month, is this a horror podcast? We've been doing a lot of horror lately.
Ah, whatever. Yeah, the thing is with our podcasts is we're not trying to force anything. I think if we have a good idea, we do it. So very much with you and I, especially with our website, because we write whatever we want, basically. So I think when it comes to podcast topics, we just do what we're passionate about that week.
And it's funny too. There have been times where we've gone like 5, 6, 7 episodes with no horror, and I'm just like, oh, come on, listener questions. Give me something gory.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of what we're into, and I don't know. I think we should let it happen organically as opposed to kind of forcing in like one for one. And we have an extensive back catalog. So if you just started listening to us and you got to catch up, if there's like a horror pod you want to listen to, go listen to something else in our beautiful back catalog.
I know, you can go all the way back to the days of Kurt Russell's Best Sleeveless Moments.
And if you love our podcast, make sure to go to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and review. Please.
I believe we just got a few kind reviews lately, didn't we?
Yeah, it's been really nice. I appreciate everyone doing that. I never thought if I'd ask, people would actually do it. So,
yeah, you know, if people ask me, it's like I want to reciprocate, but it's like, you know what, guys? Like, send me a link to your episode. Like, I sit in a lab all day in front of my microscope working on my – I'm an entomologist working on bugs. And it's like, I listen to a few podcast episodes a day. If you're looking for this, send me an episode. I want to hear something.
That's right.
But, yeah, we really appreciate it all. It's wonderful.
Yeah, share. Send us questions, you know, like send us mailbag questions, whatever you want. Just send them over to us where, you know, we want to build a good community here of podcasting and blogs and websites.
You know, it's actually interesting. A lot of the people who submit questions are the people who I start listening to sometimes. Now, sometimes people are sending us questions because I talk to them because I listen to their podcast. And then other people randomly sent us a question. And then I started listening to their podcast. It's a nice community building exercise. Or not exercise, I don't know. Experience?
Yeah.
I'm liking it.
Yeah,
for sure. I'm liking it. We're like one of those giant Lego structures where someone says, that looks like it took a lot of work. And it does, too, because you know what? We love our podcast, and we know all you guys do who have your own podcasts. It's a lot of fun. But speaking of podcasts, we've got one. You know, we have been recently getting some reflections on our recent podcast, so I thought I'd go back and look at what some people's responses have been after our episodes have dropped or in response to our episodes. What do you think of that?
Dig it.
So back in episode 113, when we did Insidious 4, that was 2 weeks ago, Neil from Greenville, South Carolina, had submitted a listener question. And he asked us, why do people spend their hard-earned money on terrible movies? And you know what? We answered it, and we had fun with it, and we appreciate Neil's question. But I prompted Neil to answer us, what is his definition of a terrible movie? And you know what? Neil responded. And I think his answer is a touch on the generic side, and that's fair. We're hedging our bets, right? We're hedging our bets, right? We want to stay safe. But Neil says, here are my terms. One, any sequel past number two, not including trilogies. And these are, he wrote in general with exceptions, so we won't attack all the way. But two, imitator releases from another studio. For example, Avengers versus Justice League or Armageddon versus Deep Impact. Three, killer animal movies, and four, remakes. And before I jump on board with our last non-horror episode, he said Jumanji is an exception to the remake rule. So what's your response to this? What do you think of his four general rules for a terrible movie?
I appreciate that, Neil, and I respect your opinion.
But you're wrong.
No, man. But weren't we talking about this the other day? Like, every single person on this planet has a different definition of what's terrible.
Totally.
So it would just be like a hard rain, purple rain conversation. Like there's no, like people just get confused.
Like purple rain is art and hard rain is a great bad movie.
Now, yeah, like, and also like terrible movies. Sometimes there are great terrible movies. I will tell you what a terrible movie
totally.
Is. I think trying to think that my definition of a terrible movie are ones that are just fake.
Like fake, like Transmorphers when Transformers came out.
No, like Larry Crown with Tom Hanks.
Oh, I gotcha. Just
where it's just everything about it is fake. There's nothing real about that movie. He's this divorced guy, but it was her fault. He has a massive house. He works at a Costco. He lost his job. Then he goes to a junior college. He immediately joins a moped gang. He falls in love with an alcoholic married woman whose husband is addicted to porn. And then he makes out with this married woman. And then everyone's like, he's the hero. But I'm like, this is the most insulting movie I've ever seen in my life. And I watched a movie called The Circle the other day with Tom Hanks.
How was that?
Megan can attest to this. I almost died. I almost
like it was just
it put me in a very stressful, bad place because it was so bad. It annoyed me so much. But it's the most fake thing on the planet. It's this book by Dave Eggers put into a movie directed by this guy I love. But it's all about like technology's everywhere. But it's like a movie made about that. And it has Emma Watson. She becomes this lemming for this company. But, you know, this company's actually bad because they want to be everywhere. And the movie, my heart started pounding. It was just the fakest, weirdest. Karen Gillan was in it. She was wasted. She's from Jumanji. It had a lot of people I liked. Like Bill Paxton was in it, dude. I was like, how dare you? Like Bill, there's a scene where like Bill Paxton like poops himself because it's really weird. And
that wasn't his last movie.
And it just felt fake. So for me, I just don't like fake. Primeval, that crocodile film, that's a fake movie. It's just like there's nothing good or bad about it. Movies that make me leave feeling nothing are what are terrible to me.
About The Circle, by the way. Now, I was very intrigued by that movie, but not enough to go see it. But when I saw the trailer, the first thing that came to my mind was this is Antitrust Part 2.
And like the poster of The Madness of King George, look up the poster, Madness of King George movie poster. You'll see an old man running through like a hallway. That's what I wanted to do after the movie.
Just away from the movie.
I just wanted to run. I would have ran through my door and caused like a mark-shaped thing.
So when I read Neil's rules, I thought of two things. The first thing I thought of was Nightmare on Elm Street's Part 3 and 4, which I love. Yeah. But again, he said these are generalities. You know, there are exceptions. But then I thought of Piranha 3 Double D, which is a sequel of a remake of a killer animal movie. And I love that terrible movie. Although Piranha 3D was much better, and the original Piranha is a classic. And there was an original Piranha 2.
Yeah, James Cameron.
But that's, I think that that's like the triple exception for
I also think movies, the majority of the time, movies that are cult classics that come out 10 years after the original are mostly bad. I love Blade Runner. That's an exclusion. But Joe Dirt 2, Boondock Saints 2, Zoolander 2. The only reason they exist is because there's a cult audience around them. And those movies caught lightning in a bottle, and there's a reason that they're cult films. So you can't...
And does that make you nervous about Super Troopers 2?
Little
bit.
Yeah, because it might just be more. Like,
yeah.
You eat a hamburger. Hey, that's great. You don't put 14 more patties on it. Like, you're going to eat it, but you're just going to be stuffed and you're going to feel gross. Like, just give me a little bit. Like, I don't know. That's a weird analogy. But,
Well, it's very, very fitting for me.
Yeah. Yeah, but you would love that.
You'd be like, I mean, you knew who your audience was when you were saying that.
You would come running out of the restaurant with that thing in your hand and you would just put it up like Judd Nelson from, Breakfast Club, and you'd be like, "Hey, Mark, look what I got!" I just think those movies, you can't replicate what those movies did, because a lot of these films were, a lot of people didn't really regard them when they first came out for a reason. Because Zoolander really caught people off guard. Boondock Saints, Joe Dirt, like these movies have smaller audiences that are very vocal. So I think a lot of the time these sequels just have no magic behind them. The first one had magic. The second one, there's no magic.
This is exactly why I'm happy that Van Damme never did any of his own sequels.
Yeah, like just. I don't know. I just think those movies, some are good. You know, Blade Runner 2049, I thought was beautiful.
Yes.
I just think those are what constitute terrible movies for me, because there's no point to them and they're fake and bland. Like, I will watch Troll 2 and just love it, because it was made by a guy who thought he was making a great movie, but it was horrible. As far as killer animals go, Deep Blue Zebra.
Dude.
Deep Blue Zebra.
One of the best movies ever.
And there was one more and I forgot it. I think he is talking about Hard Rain. And that is movies that feature jet skis.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh my God. And Jaws though. Jaws, killer animal movie.
Yeah.
I mean, Jaws. I mean, we're talking about Piranha is basically a school fish version of Jaws. And Deep Blue Sea is like a contemporized honorarium, it seems, to Jaws.
Lake Placid, I enjoyed. Anaconda because of John Voight's performance.
That's deliciously bad is what I'm going to call that movie.
Yeah. Terrible to me. I don't know. If I enjoyed something, and this, you're going to hate this, but Green Lantern, I thought, is an example of a terrible film because of this. Martin Campbell directed it. He did Casino Royale, Zorro. He did GoldenEye. This guy is a very good director. Ryan Reynolds is in it. Dude's really, really, really likable. Like, I don't know how you cannot make Ryan Reynolds likable, but I watched Green Lantern and I felt nothing. I sat in the theater. I didn't smile and I was never annoyed enough to make a cringe. And I was never happy enough to smile. I was never like, I never furrowed my brow. I never did like a chortle. I never, I never got bored enough to pick my nails. I just kind of sat there and it existed in front of me.
That's fair. Yeah. Well, I'll acknowledge that was some terrible filmmaking. I enjoyed it, but mostly for virtue of the fact that Ryan Reynolds was in it.
I liked him more in the 3 minutes in X-Men or the one movie where he's talking about bringing swords to his ex-girlfriend's wedding. X-Men Origins.
Right. Yeah, where he had his little Wade Wilson role, first Wade Wilson role.
Just don't give him parent issues. Just let him be Ryan Reynolds. Taika Waititi was in that. Did you know that? From What We Do in the Shadows, the guy who directed Thor Ragnarok, he was his nerdy buddy.
Oh, cool.
So what about you, man? What about this? Like, I really waxed poetic here. I stole Neil's thunder.
No, really. For me, it really came down to, like, just thinking of the fact that, yeah, there were a couple of tandem Nightmare on Elm Street. These were the first... I didn't have to think about these. They just came. But Piranha 3 Double D, I'm calling it Double D now. It's like, is that what I'm supposed to call it? So I guess I feel the need to make the distinction between a terrible movie and an air quotes bad movie. Because we love us some bad movies. I'm assuming that when he says a terrible movie, he means a movie that he absolutely didn't enjoy. But then again, yeah, it's like you said, we all have our own terrible movies, don't we? I mean, you see the stuff that I put out every month on our website. I go out of my way to watch some nonsense bad movies. And you know what? A bunch of them are just honest, sincere pleasures to me. And I realize that most of the free world is going on Amazon as soon as they can to write one star, worst thing I ever saw. And I'm just like, I loved it for these reasons. I'm going to write you 1,000 words about why I enjoyed this bad movie. You know?
Yeah. If you hate a movie that much, I think that's almost good.
If it gets you to talk about it that much.
I just like The Square so much, I will never rate it.
The Square?
Or The Fire. What's the movie?
Where the Circle?
The Circle. I forgot the name. I just said The Fire. What's The Fire?
You were thinking of, you totally got yourself with The Rain and Rain and The Rain of Fire.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
I think that just came full square back to you.
I started sweating while watching The Circle.
Because you were nervous. How much was left?
My heart started pounding. The kid from Boyhood got like really misused. I was in bad shape. So okay. I don't know. For me, terrible movies are whatever people think are terrible. And I think we should respect that because no one's ever going to agree. And I don't want to sway anybody else, like, because I don't want them swaying me. So I just gave what my examples are, and I get it, Neil. I get you, man. I'm hip to it.
I feel you. And you know what? If I was a betting man, if I was just even money kind of betting, I'd bet on his rules.
Yeah.
It's generalized. I'd bet on his rules. I think it's only going to be like a 55-45 for me because I like a lot of weird shit. But, you know, I still bet on his four terms.
And if you guys want to read about remakes, I analyzed every single remake from the 21st century. And so go to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I think type in remakes. I actually did every single horror remake. I broke down the data for all horror remakes. And then I broke down the data for all 21st century remakes. So you can get basically all you need to know about remakes at moviesfilmsandflicks.com with an X.
With actual data.
Actual data.
Actual data. So we had another reflection on last week's episode. Last week's episode was episode 114, and we discussed office horror. We went over the two movies, The Belko Experiment and Mayhem. And the Horror Movie Podcast, you can find on Twitter, is at Horror Movie Cast, provided a listener question, and it pertained to the kinds of enemies that people make or friendships people make or who they fight in these kinds of movies and how it affects them. And you know what? Horror Movie Cast or the Horror Movie Podcast wrote a little follow-up commentary because I was kind of reflecting during our episode as to what other office horror is out there. So they wrote us, does Dalton's Severance count as office horror? They are borderline. And add The Night Watchman to your office horror list. And then after that, Young Ghoul 94 added Bloodsucking Bastards, which I haven't seen yet. I'm interested in that. And the upcoming Office Uprising movie. And when I looked that up, I saw that the poster, it kind of looked like some kind of Zombiegeddon started because of, I guess, an energy drink called Volt on the movie poster, almost like the Chicken Nuggets and Cooties. But they're giving some other suggestions for office horror. I have seen none of these movies. I think, Mark, did you comment about Stalled or Severance?
Well, Stalled, he's just in a bathroom in an office building. But he's being attacked by zombies. So I guess that's technically office horror. So yes, it's in a bathroom inside an office building. So yeah, Severance is more like a corporate retreat horror. Because they're out on in Severance, they go out on a corporate retreat and they get murdered in the woods.
Office horror adjacent, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like a corporate retreat horror.
And then, have you heard anything about Bloodsucking Bastards? Yeah, I remember seeing a trailer for that.
Pedro Pascal's in it. Sweet Lou from Grind? And
Sweet Lou.
Remember Sweet Lou?
Yeah.
And the guy from Super Troopers in the beginning in the car, Joey Kern is in it. Pedro Pascal. Fran Kranz, who I saw with James Earl Jones on Broadway, and you can't take it with you. But from Cabin in the Woods, he's in there. Yeah, so that is office horror. So I would add Stalled and Bloodsucking Bastards to that. But I would say Severance is like corporate.
And wasn't there also, and I'm just thinking of this now, and I haven't seen it, and I only saw the trailer once, but wasn't there a Norwegian movie called Headhunters?
Oh, no, that's a Joe Nesbo book. It's basically about a thief who has an inferiority complex, and he's married to like a really beautiful blonde woman, and he just feels like she's going to leave. So then he rips off Jamie Lannister. And it's great. Actually, Headhunters is on Netflix, and if you can watch it, watch it. It's very, very, very good. Headhunters, it's like Bugs Bunny. It's like Looney Tunes meet the Coen brothers. Very, 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 very good film. I just kept saying very. I couldn't stop.
Well, you know, it's like, I'm actually curious, now that we have all these suggestions, and almost every movie mentioned, that I had heard of was a movie that I wanted to see and never got around to seeing. So I feel like as soon as we finish, I have to go update my Netflix and Amazon Prime and just see what's out there for me. Because, I'd like to see a little more office horror, hashtag office horror. But that's cool. I like that people are responding. You know, it's like we're putting this out there and people just want to jump in and share their opinions too.
That's right.
Well, I think I also have a listener question for us.
Wait, what?
I know, right? It's our participation in these podcasts has just gone up and up every episode, I feel, for the last month. But a returning listener question provider, the Fear Merchant, asks three little questions. One, what do you do in the shadows?
I get out of the sun.
Bad stuff, man. Bad stuff happens in the shadows, if you're saying what you do in the shadows. I think of the movies like that 2002 Darkness movie with Anna Paquin. I think of that 2002 also movie called They,
Pitch Black.
Where that woman...
Oh, They, yep.
Yeah, They, where that woman was afraid of something that haunted her from her childhood that's in total darkness, and it was some weird crawling, weird spidery demon monster. And I think of that movie Lights Out. What was that, 2016-17?
Yep, yep.
Like all those monsters where specifically when the light is out, they can approach you, but when the light is on, they won't. And then there was that Guillermo del Toro kind of failure, in my opinion, that Afraid of the Dark. Is that what it was?
Yeah, don't be afraid of the dark.
But it's like, darkness and horror. It's like, what do you do in the shadows? Bad stuff. Bad stuff happens in shadows.
Can I tell you something? I don't watch movies that tell me what to do.
You don't like to be told what to do.
So don't be afraid of the dark. Call me by your name. Like, no.
That's right. Instead of call me by your name, make it my name is Bruce.
Yeah, exactly. what do I do in the shadows? I kind of just relax.
That's a good thing. You know, I watch horror movies in the shadows.
Yeah, in your 10-foot tall chair while drinking old Rasputin. With tears rolling down your eye.
Wait, speaking of vampire movies, though, his second of three little questions was, what was your favorite depiction of a vampire?
Max Schreck, Willem Dafoe, Shadow of a Vampire. Shadow of a Vampire.
I'm a little torn between Tom Cruise as Lestat in 1994's Interview with the Vampire and, is his name Park something Hook, the guy who plays Father Sang in Thirst?
Oh, yeah. He was really good in that.
Yeah. I thought of Thirst and Lestat. It's like I thought of my mainstream Victorian, and then I thought of, like, this weird dark path.
Yeah. I think Thirst would be number two for me, but have a Shadow of the Vampire. It's, like, about the filming of Nosferatu, and... The explanation is it's hampered by the fact that its star, Max Schreck, is taking the role of a vampire far more seriously than seems humanly possible. So the plot of Shadow of the Vampire is John Malkovich actually gets a vampire to be in Nosferatu, and he, like, makes some crazy deals with him, and they're filming – it's about the filming of the classic film Nosferatu, but they're saying that Max Schreck was a vampire. And it's Willem Dafoe just being a vampire. Amazing. And there's this scene where – John Malkovich isn't going to part with the actress, so Max Schreck is like, give me the writer. And Cary Elles is in it. So him and between this and Bram Stoker's, he's like in two of my favorite vampire films. But Max Schreck, Shadow of the Vampire. That's fine.
That's cool. And I still haven't seen that. And listeners might look forward to hearing us do an episode of that in the next couple months.
Yeah, I would love to do that in 30 Days a Night, maybe.
I'm down. I'm so down for that. Well-dressed vampires and... vampires that need makeup. That's the theme. And the third question, and you know, this has actually come up many, many times in social media, so it felt appropriate to broach it on an episode. The Fear Merchant asks, when am I guesting? And the Fear Merchant is a good friend of the pod. And I'd actually like to start with this one, Mark, if you don't mind. A year ago, John Franklin, who played Isaac, the head bad guy in the original Children of the Corn, approached us and asked to be on our podcast. And we thought about it, and just logistically, our schedules, the amount of work that goes into getting one of these together in the first place, we're not in the best place to do that. We love this and we love to have guests, I think, but it's really difficult. I find myself at a loss for words even when I thought about it. It's tough because this is our passion, but it's difficult to coordinate. What would you feel about that, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to have guests eventually, but I think we're getting into a nice flow right now since, I took over editing. We took over kind of this, just kind of me and you, as opposed to Lazvath, who will be back in the future as a guest. But I think once we kind of get on our, get our feet settled, get into a nice flow of podcasting, I'd be more than welcome to it.
Yeah. I think it would also help if for some reason that person was in our general areas and could come to my house, and or I was in their area and could go to their house, or, you know, things like that to limit the connections. Yeah. Issue. But, so, you know, these are just logistical, technical aspects.
The general manager of Cigar City Brewery, beer company, should go to your house and record a podcast with you.
Yeah, he absolutely should. He can bring some beer. We can have some bottle sponsorship, Mr. Cigar City. I assume your surname is Cigar City, or is your last name City,
yeah,
sir?
Like, you know, Mr. Coors Light is a great guy.
Yeah.
Mrs. Heineken.
Yep. And Mr. Light.
Yep.
First name Michelob.
Yep. Yeah, Michelob's a good dude.
Mick. Good old Mick.
Good old Mick and good old Sig.
I've been enjoying that Cigar City. You know, so Neil, who wrote in earlier about his listener question from a couple episodes earlier, he actually asked me when he saw me that I was drinking their guava sour. He asked me to get him a couple bottles. I'm going to be not shipping because that would be breaking the law. So I will not be shipping them to him in the next couple weeks.
You will be delivering them
right
via your vehicle packed right safely.
That lovely Cigar City sour beer, which I love.
I think we should get into the topic. What do you think?
Absolutely, man. So, you know, you were the one who really brought this up. Like, what spurred your interest in our topic for today?
All right. So our topic for tonight is Bram Stoker's Dracula. And this is a film that I watched when I was 11 years old, and I've never been able to shake it. It was out of my league when I was 11, but watching it was just insane. And it's always been on my brain, and I'm rhyming really well right now. But I recently managed an event in Napa. And the day after the event, my wife and I went on a winery tour. And it's not like people, you know, you're going to be pretentious and be like, oh, why'd you go there? But I just wanted to see the movie props because I heard there's a lot of props at Francis Ford Coppola's winery. So we went, and at the winery, they had the flayed man war outfit that Vlad wore in the beginning of Bram Stoker's Dracula. And I was like, holy crap. Like, that's awesome. I was like, I need to watch this movie again. And then I was listening to a Ben Mendelsohn podcast.
Ben Mendelsohn has a podcast?
Well, he was on an episode of Happy, Sad, Confused where he was talking about how much he loves that movie, and so did the host. And then a friend of mine, Zach Beckler, wrote about it because the 25th anniversary was last November. And so it's just been on my mind. And I've really kind of seen a lot of people defending it as of late. I think there's very easy ways to make fun of it, but I've really witnessed this groundswell of support for it. So I brought it up to you and you were like, yeah, I just bought the 4K. And we planned this probably, a month ago, and I watched it again. And holy crap, man, this is just such – Bram Stoker's Dracula is a beautiful film. I mean, it won Best Set Design. I think it won Best Makeup at the Academy Awards, and it won Best – best costumes. And I think it is just a beautiful film. And it's the film that only an auteur like Francis Ford Coppola could make. And what's interesting, can I get into some backstory of it real quick?
Oh, you jump in, man. You jump deep.
So Coppola ruled the 70s. And in the 80s, he had a lot of commercial disappointments. So in 92, Winona Ryder and him were clearing the air because Godfather 3, Winona Ryder was supposed to star, and she dropped out last minute. That forced him to put his daughter, Sofia Coppola, in it. And her performance has been critically hated on, but that's only because she had to jump in at the last minute to fill in Winona Ryder's shoes. So they were clearing the air. And Winona Ryder was like, hey, you got to read this script by this guy, James Hart. And she basically said the script was like the book. It was like Bram Stoker's book, a lot of diaries, the way he told it. It wasn't like the old Hammer films with Christopher Lee and just Bela Lugosi. It wasn't like those classic Dracula films. This one was more close to the source material. So Francis Ford Coppola pitched it, and he got approval. And they didn't want to – he's like, you know what, guys? I'm going to be on best behavior. I'm going to just shoot this film in studios. I'm just going to take 99.9 of this film. It was filmed in a studio. So you don't have to worry about me in Vietnam or Italy with my drugs – with my cast on drugs having heart attacks. Like, I'm going to be here in the studio. But the problem was the studio was like, yeah, that's great. Sign him up. They gave him $40 million in 92. The problem was he wanted to do everything in camera. So what in camera means is that there's no visual effects. Everything that you're seeing happened on camera. So sometimes they had to film the mist separately, film that, put that footage into a refrigerator, and shoot over it again. So everything that's on that film that you see was shot in camera with special effects. The visual effects crew said, no, we're not going to do this. So he fired them all, and he brought in his 29-year-old son, Roman, who had never worked on anything so big. So you have this massive film with a huge cast, Winona Ryder, Anthony Hopkins, Keanu Reeves, Gary Oldman, just a hot cast, Richard E. Grant, Carrie Ells, Sadie Frost, Tom Waits for you know, just Monica Bellucci, just great stars. So this whole film, everything you see was shot in camera. So what you see, they did practically on set, which is insane. Miniatures, we're talking. They had mock-ups, miniatures. They had, you know, when he's reading a letter, you see the picture of Winona Ryder falling. Remember when Vlad is reading mm-hmm. the thing? So this movie, I think, has stood the test of time, much like Star Wars, much like They Live, Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, films like that that excel in special effects and practical effects. And I'm not going to say it's the most coherent film, but I think pound for pound, it's what it, I think it creates some of the most striking visuals pound for pound of any movie in the last 30 years. That's because he went insane. You know, Francis did some crazy stuff on it, but pound for pound, I think this is one of the most beautiful films around.
I'm going to agree with you. I thought that a lot of the shots were just gorgeous. I mean, not just atmosphere, but this movie wasn't just horror, and it wasn't even just horror and fantasy. It was horror, it was fantasy, it was romance.
Yeah.
And I felt like all those things actually were represented in equal parts. I felt that a lot more strongly when I saw it the second time. I saw it twice in the last 2 days. So when I saw it the second time, that really resonated more with me. But his shots, man, there's so much in there. It almost seems magical. You know, so the opening shot of this film, we're looking at the top of this dome-like church, and the imagery is very powerful. It doesn't look like real life, but it almost looked like, I don't know, like a graphic novel, like a Frank Miller thing.
Yeah.
Back then, like, what else did this? This is unusual. And it opened with this cutout silhouette over actors' silhouettes, war scene, which is the kind of thing that we see in Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, or Kubo and the Two Strings. These are very contemporary ideas that I'm not doing a full research on it, but I feel like that was really, really rare back then. And he's doing all these different styles in the beginning and different shot styles throughout the movie that really just take me somewhere beyond that. This is a horror movie. This is many movies.
And you know what I loved? I mean, 92 was the year of Jurassic Park. So you have Jurassic Park around this time. Here, let me check so I don't get... I think Jurassic Park... Yeah, no, 93, I'm sorry. But this is around the same time that Jurassic... So during this time, this is after The Abyss. So amazing special effects occurred. What I love is that Coppola used technology that could have been used to shoot Nosferatu. And there's several scenes where he bought really old cameras to shoot. I know I just stepped on your toe, but just in regards to the shots. So I just think it's amazing that they filmed this during a time when there were movies that looked beautiful. Like, this is such a, like, yeah. So I compare this movie to this. So he goes to the studio. Hey, man, I'm going to retell Dracula all in the studios and have an A-list cast. And the studio is like, yeah. And then he's like, however, it's going to be like an erotic dream. And everyone's like, I mean, cool. People like that. Like that'll, you know, that people like that kind of stuff. Like gratuitous nudity. Yay. I'm going to use all practical effects. Yeah. Like, what do you mean? Like, I wanted to shoot it with all, like, so I feel like at first they were really excited and they said yes. And then he kind of told them everything he was going to do. And everyone's like, oh shit. And there was a lot of problems behind the scenes. Like, it went too long. It made a boatload of money. But, this movie was almost like, Not as much ridiculed as Waterworld, but there was a lot of bad buzz behind it.
You know, I have trouble understanding that. From the pre-production side or, you know, filmmaking studio side, I guess I see that apprehension. But God, like, I am enamored with this movie. I am true blood glamored by this movie. You know, I mean, I'm already rhapsodizing about all the shots and the visuals, but the scoring, good Lord.
Yeah, it's like a beautiful score.
Everything that could possibly, every component that you could put into nailing whatever tone you're targeting, I feel like he just hammered that atmosphere perfectly all the time. I really do. And so when people pick at it, you know, I don't know, I get a little defensive. We love our movies. Sometimes we get defensive when people pick at our movies.
Yeah.
But I don't, it's like, I feel like someone should be forced to acknowledge what went into this and what was impressive about it before they say, but I didn't like it. It's yeah. okay to tell me you didn't like it. Don't tell me it sucks. Don't tell me it's bad.
Like you can dislike a sports team, but you can't say they're bad athletes.
They're better than me.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but yeah, let's kind of jump into this movie. And when I was 11, I remember watching this and the scene where Vlad is he has to go to war. You know, he's part of the church. He goes and he battles crusades, right? Is this around the, it's 1492, it's 1400s and he goes and battles. But that scene, what I always remember is when he sticks the men on the poles and hangs them up in the air, just right. the visual of that. And then he comes back, he finds out someone sent a fake letter. His wife, she killed herself. He renounces God and becomes a vampire. He stabs a cross and it bleeds.
Dude, that scene, by the way, that was one of the cooler, like, sacrilegious scenes. I'm not saying that sacrilege is cool, but that and some of the scenes from Stigmata are kind of like in my tops for contemporary sacrilegious scenes.
Yeah, and then you know, just the way they shot it and Gary Oldman's intensity, dude smolders. Like The Rock would be jealous of his smolder. And
I forgot how young he was when he made this, by the way.
This is 2 years before Professional, where you know he really. I mean, he made Sid and Nancy before this. People knew him as a great actor, but this is before he was really big. And he's probably going to win an Oscar this year, which is pretty awesome. I don't know. So I guess cut to current day. Then you got Keanu Reeves, Jonathan Harker. I want to get this out of the way. Keanu Reeves, right? His accent in this movie is very bad. However, I've been reading a lot of interviews, and Francis Ford Coppola basically said Keanu Reeves was the nicest guy, and all he wanted to do was perfect this accent. And Francis Ford Coppola just kind of felt bad for him, and he thought he was such a nice guy that he was never that tough on him. So he just kind of let him... He never pushed him because he was just kind of worried about how, you know, he was just so earnest at this time, Keanu Reeves. So, yes, Keanu Reeves had this accent, but at the end of the day, the director yelled cut and he printed it and he put it on the screen. So.
And that just encourages Keanu to keep doing what he's doing.
And you know, he worked his butt off, and you can see in this film just some of his reactions. This guy put his heart into it. He just didn't have the skill set yet because he hadn't been forced to do any of these kind of movies. I mean, would Johnny Depp have been better at this time? Probably. I don't blame Keanu because at the end of the day, someone yells cut.
Like, right. So someone's not telling him he's missing the mark.
Yeah. And he tried hard. He just couldn't nail it. Like, I don't know.
I swear, if you could see anybody trying hard on screen, it was Keanu. He was trying to own that so hard. And I gotta say, yeah, I don't know what that sound was that he was making accent wise, but whatever it was consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like a movie. It's no, you know, like there's so many movies out there where you catch like someone saying half a sentence where it's like, wait, they just lost their accent. Yeah, that didn't happen.
I was going to make a joke about how his family moved from, you know, what, Lebanon, and he was second generation and he was just trying to adapt the accent. Like I was going to make a joke about that, but that would have brought more attention to his accent.
You know, I wasn't unhappy with Keanu in this movie.
No.
You know, he didn't nail that accent, but I was fine with him.
I loved his journey to Dracula's castle in the train.
Yes! So much cool imagery, too.
And, like, so he's on this train. You see the – like, he's just – it's beautiful imagery. And one scene I want to talk about is the carriage driver with the claw.
Yes!
Now,
yes!
The scene where he takes his hand – like, so this carriage driver sticks his hand about 8 feet. Puts his hand on Keanu's shoulder and pulls him into the carriage. They actually shot that on the crane. The crane moved him when they did that. Like that was like they really did that.
But this coach driver, what was it?
Dracula?
What? So like, is that what? I didn't know how to take that. Like, because it wouldn't just be some minion. It was clearly something evil. So you thought that was Dracula then?
I think so.
Okay. I mean, it was this big hand.
Yeah, I feel like it was Dracula, or is it his assistant Hank?
His assistant Hank could be Hank.
So it's either Hank.
It's Renfield's cousin Hank.
Yeah, it's Hank. It's Hank or it's
Hank
Dracula.
Renfield. It's Hank Renfield. Now that was really cool, by the way. So that whole mysticism with the carriage, but just to jump back a little earlier though, the sacrilege scene in the beginning. Is it me, or was that – now, Sid and Nancy was one big spaz out. But in terms of an on-point, an on-cue tantrum, was that the beginning of Gary Oldman's historic cinematic tantra?
Well, I think the car had already been push-started with Sid and Nancy. And then I think it was helped with this And then I think it went to full insanity with The Professional. Everyone, you know what I'm talking about? Just as, like, I don't know.
Right.
I think the car, it was already going when he did this, but that was a great temper tantrum.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that, The Fifth Element, The Professional, they're all separated by 2 years. I love that. His intensity, you mentioned it, his intensity is perpetual in this movie. So it's like whenever we mention anything with him, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, he, you want to hear something cool? People are like, shut up, Mark. I want to hear about the movie, not the fact. But, Francis Ford Coppola told the designer Iko Ishioka, she was a graphic artist from Japan who did some really great artwork for his Apocalypse Now films. He told her that he wanted the wardrobes to be the sets because the sets weren't very expensive. Like, some sets were expensive, but the majority of the time were spent on the wardrobe. So, you know what? The first thing I noticed was Keanu's awesome coat when he got out of the stagecoach. But I want to talk about Dracula's red robe.
Oh my God, best robe ever.
With the phoenixes on it.
He put Snoke to shame with that robe.
Yeah, Snoke was like lounging. His robe was a commitment. And,
I mean, he's just trailing 20 feet of red behind him like a blood bride.
Like, I feel like Dracula is one of the worst hosts of cinematic history.
You mean because of his temperament at Keanu's first dinner?
Yeah. He's just I would be petrified in fear if I was at that place.
Dude, he's swinging a sword. It's like he swings a sword at you when you say the wrong thing about his history lesson of his family. And I agree. If someone swings a sword at me, you know what I don't say? I'm sorry, I have offended you. Yeah. No. I'm going to get up, I'm going to drop kick you in the nuts and run.
I would just be frozen. I'd be like, hey, man.
Or that.
Not bad.
Little of that.
What's over there?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, you got something on your face, Bruce Campbell.
Do you want to hear what? You want to hear something funny? So the shadow, Dracula's shadow, in this film, they had a guy try to mimic Gary Oldman's movements the best he could, but it never was right. And I think that made it better.
Wait. You mean it wasn't deliberately a self-animated shadow?
No, it was a guy doing the shadow.
I honestly thought that they were showing that his shadow had its own, like, sentience.
Oh, there were moments. There were moments, but there's moments when it's supposed to be a normal shadow, but the guy just couldn't get it right.
Whatever that guy did, I loved everything that I saw on screen about it. I loved that it was almost never synced. My eyes always drew to it. Oh, that's cool.
When you were 12, 13, I was probably, this came out in 92, so I was about 11. What did you think? Like, we had probably watched Reservoir Dogs by now. Like, I was deep in, you know, like, R-rated movies. But for some reason, dude, this movie punched my poor 11-year-old face in the face. Did it hit you like that or no?
You know what's funny? Like, no. So back then, and I don't remember super clearly, but back then, I think that I just wasn't taking movies seriously yet when I was first seeing this. So when I saw it, I was just like, that is a really cool movie. You know, kind of like A Nightmare on Elm Street was a really cool movie. And I didn't really appreciate it for what it was. I probably saw this 5, 6, 7 times by the time I finished my undergrad in 2003. And then I didn't see it again until 2 days ago. And I've since seen it twice more. And the 2 times in the last 2 days, it has enchanted me. But back then, I just remember thinking it was an awesome, maybe classic movie. That was it. It was almost because of the character iconism more than what was exacted on screen that I remembered.
Well, so you and I kind of watch movies differently because I specifically remember going, man. Like, I remember watching Reservoir Dogs and going, this is out of my league.
No, if anything, I was saying man because I was like, there are a lot of boobs in this movie. And that's awesome because I'm 12.
Yeah, I was like 11 going, what is happening? But
no, I don't recall that. Yeah, I just remember it being like I was pretty desensitized at an early age as well, though. Like my first horror movies were my first horror movie ever. After my dad went to sleep, I was up with my intoxicated uncles and my first horror movie was Evil Dead 2.
Nice.
My very first, like I'm 10 years old. 10 years old, Evil Dead 2. Like, not Ernest Scared Stupid first, Evil Dead 2 with blood geysers and screaming headless naked ballerina zombies. You know, like, that was where I started.
All right, so while we go take a quick trip to the counselor so John and I can talk about our early youth and how it affected us, we'll take a break real quick and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. We're doing better now. John cried a lot, and we started calling it Hard Rain, and he started laughing. But then he started crying. And then for some reason, he started crying again. And then I started crying because of just the way that your emotions turned. And then we had to pay the lady like $400.
That sounds typical.
Yeah. Psychiatrist. Great. So, question?
Yeah, we got another listener question. A return listener question submitter Alex Vorkov from Twitter asks, what did Gary Oldman, the world's best actor, think when he heard various American co-stars attempt at an English accent? I'll diplomatically say that a couple of the key cast members of this film tried super hard to do English accents and fell short. Gary Oldman, who is English and a brilliant actor, had multiple scenes with those said cast members. And just as a follow-up with that question, Slasher Trash, also from Twitter, asks, did anybody believe that Keanu Reeves was really English? I assume he means as a character. And we've started to address this in our first half. What's your take overall?
I guess, but I feel like if he knew that somebody was working really hard, I'd assume that he wasn't going to hate him. He's probably annoyed by it. But yeah. I don't think anyone can hate Keanu.
Yeah. Well, also, if I'm not mistaken, I think that Alex Vorkov is from the UK.
Gotcha. I guess we pick up on accents, too, when people try bad American accents. But I don't know. I think we've covered this. I think I'm guessing. I like Gary Oldman.
Yeah, no,
I bet he tried to help. I don't know. If you meet somebody who's trying really hard at something, like, you can't be that pissed at him. Right? I don't know. I think you just gotta.
Well, you know, Gary Oldman was younger too.
Yeah.
So I imagine that. Well, I'm not saying that Gary Oldman is less patient now, but when I think that as a younger actor who had less clout, I think that that inherently makes you, you know, more patient and understanding that people are trying. It's not like he was acting for 20 years.
Yeah.
So at the time.
I want to try something right now. You're Keanu and I'm Gary Oldman. Let's act out a dinner scene from this movie. You want to do it?
Yes.
All right, Keanu.
This is a terrible Keanu. Okay.
All right. So this is going to make everyone feel better about Keanu Reeves' accent. So I'm going to be playing Gary Oldman from Dracula.
Oi! So you're going to do a British guy doing a Romanian accent.
Yes.
And I'm going to do an American doing something like a British accent.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Keanu. How is your blood sandwich?
It's very good.
Great. I noticed you're not eating your wolf tongue. Do you not like wolf tongue?
I have a mild gluten allergy. Is there gluten in this wolf tongue?
I do not understand. What is gluten?
It's something that wussy America. Oh dear, I shouldn't do that on the podcast. I don't want to alienate anybody.
Excuse me, Mr. Keanu. I thought you were English.
I am English.
It's a very curious accent.
I have offended you. I am sorry.
It's fine. It's fine. Here's my sword. Take a look at sword. Let me swing sword. Hey, what's my sword?
Why are you brandishing your sword at me, bro? All
right. So now everybody, Keanu wasn't that bad.
No. So Anthony Hopkins though.
He wasn't trying to do anything.
His accent was supposed to maybe be German.
He was doing 8 gin rickeys and go to set.
Whatever. If someone's going to criticize Keanu, I would ask them to instead watch a few clips of Anthony Hopkins in this. And I think that Anthony Hopkins is, in general, great. But in this, he was just a stack of hubris, just saying whatever he wanted, however he wanted.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What's a better Anthony Hopkins throw? When he throws the three heads into the crevasse.
Or when he throws Benicio del Toro in the Wolfman?
Or when he throws the chair.
The chair.
In the Wolfman. Chair throwing or triple head throwing?
Definitely the chair. I'm going to say I wasn't impressed with his triple head throw.
It was more of a drop. It was more of a drop.
Yeah, yeah. It was just like, you know, plop off the bridge or whatever that was.
Can I ask you a question? Another Always. One? If you're a vampire hunter and you are in Dracula's lair and you cut off his three evil demon bodyguards' heads, right? Are you just going to like throw them down a crevasse, or are you going to be like, yeehaw, and just throw like an overhand? Are you going to like, you know, are you going to take one at a time and throw them like Keanu does in Replacements? Are you going to, I mean, what are you going to, I'm talking about throwing decapitated heads.
I mean, normally I think that that character, the way that character was presented, it would be like one of those Nickelodeon slam dunk contests with the with the trampoline. But because of the day that he had before that, remember in the movie though, right before that, he had one hell of an evening. So I guess like that really was where he was just like a little beaten down in his own, you know, even his own ego was beaten down. He's just like. It was like taking out the trash when you have to go to work on a Monday and you got to sleep at 4 a.m. after a bachelor party. And you just do, like that was what I saw.
Gotcha. So you're more impressed with his chair throwing than the Wolfman.
Dude, that chair throw. No, I know that was not an in-camera chair throw, but that was a very dynamic chair throw. In the history of cinematic chair throws, that probably ranks rather high.
Yeah, I mean, that. Wow, I need to write a post about the best chair throws of cinema.
You've been talking about that chair throw for, well, gosh, it's 2018. It's been almost a decade.
It was just so unnecessary.
But it looked awesome.
Yeah, just Anthony Hopkins throwing a chair.
It's like when The Rock is playing like a soccer dad and he's just standing at the sideline, but you can tell that his pecs are flexed. It's totally unnecessary. But it, you know what? It makes a lot of the crowd happy. You know, just throw a chair. Do that pec dance. I understand. That's Anthony Hopkins' your 2010 pec dance was throwing that CGI chair.
So are you saying you just compared Anthony Hopkins throwing a chair to The Rock flexing his pecs? I think that's the first time.
That anyone has ever made that analogy.
Yes.
It could be.
That's impressive.
But again, his was the accent that struck me. And some of the girls in the movie, I thought that the Lucy – I thought that she was – maybe it's not totally unnatural. I thought she was a bit exaggerated.
Yeah.
She was like an audio caricature of a British accent.
Like in Dracula, Dead and Loving It, like, but Lucy, I'm British. So are these.
That girl could not keep those boobs away.
That movie, though, this Bram Stoker's Dracula, I feel like was the Wild West. I think they put so much work into costumes and everything that they're just like, ah, whatever. Like people,
we can do whatever we want.
Yeah, people are out of their league. I think everyone was so worried about other things. I would have loved to have been on this set. So, I don't know. That's, yeah. So, you know what? Anthony Hopkins throwing chairs. That's the answer to this question.
Yep. Anthony Hopkins chair throw. Hungover, dead chick head throw. Right, so... it makes me think of that Christian Slater movie. Very Bad Things, that was like this hard R bachelor party rendition where the hooker died.
Oh yeah, that was nasty.
But it's like that triple head throw makes me think of like his morning after that.
Oh yeah. That movie was dark.
There's three more dead hookers. Sorry to our hooker listeners. My apologies. I didn't mean to.
So I have another question about this.
Okay.
The scene where he comes in. And he harasses Keanu. And then later on, he's crawling on the castle walls.
So, the shaving scene.
Yeah, he shaves him, licks the blood, then crawls on the walls.
And shatters the mirror by looking at it.
Yep.
Yeah, cool scene.
Oh, okay. But, like, just the visual of him walking like that.
You mean the wall crawling?
Yeah.
So, now, I'm pretty sure that was inspired by 1990s Exorcist 3, where the little old lady was crawling on the ceiling.
And they did on Willow, too.
Oh, right, with the trolls, right. Theirs looked more smooth, though. The Exorcist 3 had that skittish
look. Oh, yeah, you're right.
It was almost like it was fast-forwarded 1.2 to 1.5x. But I like what they did. It was neat. It made the wall crawling, because if you just showed him wall crawling – violating gravity at regular speed, I think it would look kind of weak, kind of like just because the way they did it, it made it supernatural. It honed into that animalistic link that he has to rats and wolves and bats and lesser beasts, as they call it in the movie, or in the book. And so I really like the way that they illustrated it. I'm sure that there are a lot of people who didn't like that scene and they thought it seemed weird, or maybe they actually are young horror fans who actually are saying in a negative way, like, it's just like The Exorcist 3. But I'm saying it in a good way. I think that he saw some, I'm assuming he saw that. But to me, that was something that worked really well in The Exorcist 3. And I think that that same thing worked really well here. And at the time, there weren't a lot of scenes depicting this kind of movement back then. Remember the House on Haunted Hill with the skittish, super fast forward head spinning stuff?
Yeah.
At that time, that kind of stuff had happened before. It wasn't as it became more common afterwards. But when you go back to 1992, like this kind of skittish, like adjusted speed movement, I don't think was common. It felt interesting to me. I'm sure that it felt new to people back then. But I liked that scene. I liked the. I thought though that in the bedroom before that was not so well staged, is how I'm going to say it. The things that happened in that scene didn't feel as organic.
Oh, the blood sense? And the shaving and all that?
The blood, the way that he had the sneaking up hand, and then it turned out he was still all the way back in the doorway, and then he walks up and he shatters the mirror. And the only part of that that seemed like properly done that seemed smooth to me was when he casually turned to lick the blood off.
Yeah.
And Iconic scene.
He had some pretty, there's some random cheeky moments in this. The one scene where Draco's like, I do not drink wine. Like, didn't he say that?
Yeah. So he was saying, you know, forgive me for not joining you to dine. I dined earlier and I never drink wine or something like that.
He sat down. Like there's a beat wine.
And you know, what's funny is that he's doing what is socially one of the most awkward things ever. It's like, yeah, I already ate, but go ahead and eat. I'm just going to sit here and watch you eat. No one likes that. No one in the world likes that. I don't care if you are rich and this is going to get me partnership in my law firm or whatever it is Keanu does. Like, that's an awkward thing. And he's just like, yeah, I'm going to soft-spokenly eat this quail and listen to your awkward story about your history. And then I'm going to offend you and you're going to wave a sword. But that shaving scene, though, I feel like that was an example of Coppola. He had a checklist, and a lot of the things I liked the way he depicted the things on his checklist, but he had a checklist.
No, he wrote, he did an entire book before he did this.
But I mean, he had all these things that he wanted to get on screen.
Yeah.
And that shaving scene was a scene where he could do three of them in like 90 seconds with the blood licking of the shaving, with the mirror break, with the reaching arm. And then it turns out that he was, you know what I mean? It's like he was, and then the wall crawling right afterwards. He was trying to cram a lot of content into this movie. And that was one of the moments where I felt him cramming it a little bit.
He had an entire book. He animated an entire film to show his designer's wardrobe. He showed a movie to people how he wanted this movie. It's crazy. And no, you're right. I think this was a kind of like a jam session for what, like a jam in session.
And the funny thing is, if you just show me the 30-second clips of each of those things, I liked each one. It was just in that particular 90-second scene, they didn't have the synthesis that a lot of the other scenes did for me. And I'm not saying I didn't like the scene, by the way. I like all the elements that were there. It was cool.
Do you think this movie's very coherent?
I don't necessarily think it's incoherent. But I understand where you're coming from.
For me, it felt like you said, I just think it felt like a series of scenes.
A lot of times I think that's true. Yeah. Like, every now and then he had two or three scenes that'll really gel together. And then you kind of have a jump and there it's clear the assumption being made that's happening in the gap between the two scenes. Right. But no, there's a lot of little bits that just kind of rifle along. This movie, for instance, if you completely deleted all scenes involving Renfield, completely deleted it, and showed it to someone else for the first time in their life, they'd never notice that something was missing.
Now, they would feel a void in their life that they don't get to see a square box over men's heads.
Right, perhaps. That was interesting.
You get that guy in a headlock, he's not going anywhere.
This is right. And you don't get to see Tom Waits playing a minion.
Eating bugs.
It's a raspberry. It's perfectly nutritious.
Now, I know I'm jumping in, but remember on Dracula Dead and Loving It when Renfield goes with this to the psychiatrist, and he starts eating bugs. And the guy's like, I just saw you eat that. Like, what was that? Was that an ant? He's like, no, it was a raspberry. And then the psychiatrist goes, a raspberry? You just ate a raspberry? Like, it's my favorite pronunciation of the word raspberry. But I saw Phantom Thread the other day, and she said raspberry really well, too. But it was a raspberry? Sorry. So whenever I saw him eating things, in my head, I'm going, ooh, raspberry. Yeah, that was a pretty good accent.
You nailed that
accent.
Whatever accent that was.
I nailed that. I didn't nail a specific accent. I nailed a guy trying to do an accent.
There you go. It's almost like nailing Keanu Reeves trying to do a British accent, which I failed, by the way. I like that we're throwing his Point Breakisms into his false accent. So I have a something to bring up. So this is something that's recurrent throughout the film is the not just the romance aspect, which was very strong. I'd like to get to that later, but the hypersexuality of a lot of scenes in this film.
Oh yeah.
Like, the Lucy character,
Lucy.
And Mina's staying with her friend Lucy while Harker Keanu is going, you know, across the continent to go to Dracula's, and she's writing letters. And so Lucy, you know, she falls ill when she's exposed to, you know, the vampire's bite. And it seems that her flu, her fever, one of her symptoms is that she always has a bare breast.
Yeah, one of them. I was watching
one of them. It's always the left one. It's always her left breast, but the camera side breast.
I was watching this with Megan, and Megan's
your
like,
wife.
Yeah, my
watching
wife.
Watching you with your wife.
And she's like, why is only one of her boobs always out? And I'm like, well, because the camera has to see one.
Right.
Like, I mean, this is his Francis Ford Coppola's erotic dream. But yeah, there's always one out.
So it's like there's her. There's when Keanu meets Dracula's three brides. There's a lot of brief nudity shots.
They're at the tea house. No, I'm joking.
No, I'm just saying. Like, yeah, there are a lot of there's the scene where Dracula is in his kind of wolfish hybrid form with Lucy in the courtyard where they're having their sex in the garden scene.
So he's a someone wrote a review and they said that he's a literal predator, like it's a sex predator in that.
Sure, yeah. I suppose. I mean, he was kind of – there was an ongoing charming and lulling and that kind of little telepathic connection that he had after he bit her that I guess, you know, lulled her out. But yeah, and then it did seem not 100% consensual.
And she had a really great red dress readily available.
Right, of course. But why wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
But and you know, so there's all this sexuality though, but then it's kind of counterbalanced, not to say that the sexuality isn't going to raise a lot of brows, with the hyper romantic nature. So Dracula is monstrous in a lot of scenes, right? And we see he's very temperamental, but he's also very sentimental about his things. That's why he got upset at Keanu Reeves. And then with all of his interactions when he's long-haired, sunglasses wearing, top-hatted Dracula, and it ends up into a bedroom scene with Mina, Winona Ryder, that scene, he almost interrupts the blood baptism because of his love for what he perceived as his reincarnated Elisabetta. And, you know, it's like it was really intense, like when he gets into that stuff, like Coppola was hammering the romance into this.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like he wanted it to be this kind of like sexy erotic dream. But yeah, you're right. You think that's why a lot of people like this movie is because of the core romance? I know it had a lot of great visuals, but Oldman, like he brought his smolder game on this, and there is a love story in this film. So do you think that's what brought a lot of people to watch it?
You know, it's hard for me to say. I think that the star power is what gets people through the door.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, even if you tell people everything that we're saying, I think that what's going to get someone to agree to watch this movie for the first time is the cast, you know, and in a mild interest in a vampire movie, perhaps. But then, like, once they see it, I think what keeps people's interest, if they're going to love this movie, yeah, I think the visuals, which are highly diverse and abundant and awesome. But yeah, I think that there's that intensity. I think that this is something that sentimental or romantic people will be drawn to because of that. Like, again, all he wanted for 400 years was to find some kind of love. And then he thinks he found it, and he almost interrupts the quintessential vampire movie scene, as of this movie anyway, that kind of blood baptism, like this intense scene. So, I don't know. I want to describe this film as powerful.
I have gone through what oceans of time.
Well, that's appropriate since she threw herself into water and died.
Yeah. Now, there's so many scenes to talk about here in a short amount of time, but there's a couple moments maybe I can talk about that you can kind of talk about. There's a scene where they ask how – so Lucy becomes a vampire. She dies. They put her in a coffin. She escapes. They're waiting for her. She comes with a child. So Lucy becomes a vampire, but they think she's dead, so they put her in a tomb. She dies.
Anthony Hopkins says the most hammed-up thing.
Anthony Hopkins, Carrie Ells, Billy Campbell, and Richard Grant. There's four of them. They go to her coffin. She's not there. She comes back with a child, which when I was 11 just rocked my world. It was so creepy. But they kill her. They stick a stake in her heart, chop off her head. And later on, someone's like, how did she die? And then they cut to like a Family Guy style flashback. Or it's just the four guys sitting there where she has a stake in her heart and her head's off. I was like, where did this scene come from?
But it's similarly funny because before that, when they're still at the wake, Anthony Hopkins is talking to, was it Billy Campbell or Richard Grant?
Richard Grant.
He says, Richard Grant, yeah. He says, so I need you to meet me later with some post-mortem knives. He says, well, why, an autopsy? He says, oh, no, it's not that. I just want to remove her heart and chop off her head. and he said it just, and you know it was funny. Like, Anthony Hopkins thought that was funny, and I felt that he thought that that was funny. And he's the only thing that is repetitively funny in this movie, and it's like he thought he was in a different movie sometimes. But then that scene that you just mentioned, though, that kind of Family Guy flashback where they're just awkwardly looking at this horrible scene.
I was like, what movie is this? And then they also show some like bloody, and then they cut to Anthony Hopkins cutting this massive slice of meat.
Yep, I like that too. Yeah.
I'm like, where did this, what movie, what, you can't relax while watching it, at least for me, if you're really into it. Because it's just so jarring, and there's so many like great moments, so you're never at ease while watching it. Do you think so?
Yeah, I'm into it. You actually made an interesting comment, by the way, when we were just talking about this before podcasting. You had told me how like this took a lot out of you watching this, even though you love it.
Yeah, no, I was exhausted. I don't think I could watch it a lot. I mean, it's the thing is about this movie is, there's some films that tell a very linear narrative. They tell a very traditional film. And so it can just kind of cruise by. But when you watch movies like you said, Thirst for Me or I Saw the Devil, or they're different from this, but Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula, this movie's not, I mean, obviously it follows a time frame, but it's disjointed and it's uneven and it's not entirely cohesive. And there's random moments and there's so much going on the screen that watching it, it's great. It's a compliment, but it's also very, it's not an easy watch, and that's not a bad thing.
I gotta agree with you. It's not an easy watch. It's a beautiful watch, as we've mentioned. It's definitely intense. I mean, this is kind of the heavy-handedness of a Romeo and Juliet of horror.
Yeah.
And with all the kind of the death and weight and this almost undying to the point of torture longing, as opposed to the teenage impatience and suicide in Romeo and Juliet. But also, again, beautiful movie. Would you think of the creature effects in this movie? We see kind of Wolfman Dracula. We see the Rat Man. The swarm form of rats is not really any real spectacle. But like he has a hybrid bat form scene when he's crying. He has old man Dracula. There's that wonderful makeup. There's all the hair work, of course, but that's not really a special effect. And then there's bat form Dracula when he's interrupted in the room with Mina after the blood baptism. Like these scenes, I thought that the special effects of him in bat form were, especially for their time, right up there with the bat form critter in Daybreakers.
Yeah, I think a lot of movies have stolen from this film. There were scenes in here where I watched them like that. This looks like From Dusk Till Dawn for moments. And I noticed other things and just the different forms, the huge bat Had that happened? You've watched a lot of old vampire films. I'm thinking like Near Dark, Fright Night.
Well, Fright Night did the huge bat in the finale. But the, and it also...
In that kind of form, though? The big, like, yucky form?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was more demonic looking, but it was still meant to be the hybrid bat form. It was only in the end when they killed him. In the basement?
Yeah.
And then they mimicked it in Fright Night 2 with the woman, Carmen something or other, who played that, the sister of Jerry. In the sequel, she also had, a more demonized, almost gargoyle-esque bat form. And it also had Fright Night, the first one had, the second Fright Night had the wall crawling. And that was the kind of mullet guy who turns into the wolf form of the bat. And then Meridian, which was from 1990, had the wolfman sex scene in the garden. But again, that's also just taking from Bram Stoker's Dracula. These movies are also taking off of that.
Yeah, the book.
But a lot of these scenes, though, I'm just saying, like, these scenes were done before Bram Stoker, a lot of them, but not by very far. It's usually just like one movie ahead of Bram Stoker. And then the wall crawling was also done in Exorcist, but first it was done in Fright Night 2 in 1988. And if there were other movies, I don't know them, but that's what comes to mind first. But again, we love Fright Night. One day we'll pod about that. Exorcist 3 is no piece of artwork. But when I see these scenes emulated or borrowed or modified or adopted or however you want to take it, in Bram Stoker's Dracula, I feel like anything that I've seen in a different movie was done at least as well or better in Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, I mean, 25 years later, they still stand at the test of time. I mean, when you look at these effects, Jurassic Park's effects, but I don't know how they did it. There's a couple scenes in this movie where I'm like, how did they do that? Like, just, I don't know. Maybe I'm just a sucker for nostalgia, but I've watched with kind of Hellboy and the recent Star Wars when they go to these big bazaars and there's all these creatures. Now, I know there's budgets and I know you can't design all these creatures, but none of them have impressed me as much as Star Wars, The Thing, Bram Stoker's. Do you think that's just a focus on the craft?
Less
of them?
I'm going to come back to Neil's statement. I'm speaking in generalities and not exceptions. But I think that when you have CGI in general, right, that you just know that you can make 20 characters. Now, you might have to lower the budget on each relative character or choose one set piece moment and then have a lot of background characters. But you know, you can cheaply throw together a bunch of stuff that'll be on screen for 2 seconds each, unless someone pauses on it, and you can get away with a lot. When you have to make physical effects, no matter how cheap they are, I think that more love goes into them. Yeah. That's my opinion. I think that it's about the love of the creator as opposed to the director.
Yeah. You know, I guess this goes back to Coppola saying that the costumes have to be everything. So they probably put as much work into the costumes of the animals than they did, you know, clothing Winona Ryder.
Yeah. You know, it's funny too. You mentioned the wardrobe earlier, how like he wanted the wardrobe to be the sets. Very few movies do I, just the way I watch movies, specifically notice wardrobe. In this movie, it popped every time. Lucy in her funeral gown against that dark, bleak background, of course, too.
And but when Winona Ryder's red dress?
Her red dress, the well-dressed people, I mean, it's just you know, someone made a comment on Twitter, and I didn't find their name to write them down to quote them, but someone actually asked, where did he get those sunglasses?
I don't know. This is one of his best sunglass roles, that's for sure. Well, he was great in Tinker Tailor. He had great glasses in those. Yeah, I don't know where he bought them. I mean, they were tailored.
They didn't necessarily look like something I've seen specifically, but they could have almost passed as contemporary.
Yeah.
Like, they were stylish.
If I wore glasses, well, that was very 90s too, those glasses. I mean, who knows what they were like during that Victorian, you know, like the early 1900s. But remember the 90s, a lot of the circular glasses that were going around? Yeah.
Coppola was just like, you know what? I really, really want Dracula in sunglasses. And he sends an intern across the street to a sunglass hut.
Yeah. No, you know, I would assume they're time appropriate because the designer was amazing, but I don't know. Remember that in the 90s? There was a lot of those glasses in the 90s, dude. And they all had different colored frames.
Yeah, but you know, super stylish. I don't know if there's anything in this movie that I didn't think was... You know, if there was something that I thought wasn't visually striking, I'm gonna pick. Was when they did do... When Keanu was coming in with the coachman into Dracula's lair, and for some reason they showed there was a blue energy wave at the gate.
Yeah, that was funky.
That kind of, it almost looked like, and so apparently it wasn't, but it almost looked like a weird rotoscoped, bad 80s movie, you know, ghost ectoplasm.
Yeah, I didn't dig that.
But I mean, it's so little. It's like that, those 3 seconds. You know, like, are what stand out to me is something that wasn't awesome in this movie that I saw. It's hard to pick at this movie for me.
You know who we haven't really talked about him that much. One thing I had to say is my cat Ghost watched a lot of this movie. I don't know why, but he just kept watching it. So I was impressed. He's never done that before. But I really like the characters of, I mean, Billy Campbell's Texas accent is kind of weird, but I like Billy Campbell, Carrie Ells, and Richard Grant because they just like rolled deep with Van Helsing. They just got on trains, got on horses, killed a bunch of gypsies, battled all these people. I don't know. I just love that. I remember when I was younger watching that chase, and I just like, these dudes are gangsters. They went to Romania, and they're chasing gypsies to try to kill Dracula. I don't know. I respect it. I like them. I like that aspect of this film a lot.
And that was a part of that romance, I think. And then that ending bit was something that I feel like wasn't so clearly explained but was followable, was that they were the 3 suitors for Lucy, right, before she picked a suitor. And then even after she picked a suitor, it's not like they were whimsically just, okay, well, on to the next woman. They all still deeply cared for her. They're all still giving her blood transfusions when she's dying from a vampire bite, or so they think. They're all putting their lives at risk. Yeah, you know, traveling across the continent, well, across Europe to Transylvania to intercept Dracula. And then, by the way, that scene, when we were talking about unevenness and how some things kind of jumped, the jump to the chase scene for me was the time that I felt the jilt of the unevenness more than anywhere else in the movie. Even though I liked the chase, I liked everything that led up to the chase. The fact that we went from not chasing to chasing, you know, or including the whole journey, if you will, that really was a disjunct thing for me. Like, it was almost like someone said, oh, by the way, Dracula's getting on a ship. And I'm like, what?
Yeah. And Dracula's just chilling in some dirt.
And then everyone's like, well, let's all unite. We got to go intercept Dracula. And I'm like, we do? We all do have to go? And like, I'm on board. I want to go see a fight with Dracula. And then they have this elaborate thing with the Indiana Jones tracking across the map as they're going kind of thing.
Well, he was reading
right.
Her mind, right? Mina's mind.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So he knew what was going on. And then like he foiled them. And the fact that Dracula read her mind and he started to intercept them and then they redirected, that was another jump within the jump where I'm just like, I get what you're telling me, but it didn't feel a lot of synthesis for me. And then we get to the end, though, when there's the actual physical wagon and horse chase, or the coach and horse chase.
Yeah.
So this is a fun scene. I think that it doesn't fit super well in this movie, but it's a fun scene. I like the scene. What were your feelings about this scene?
I just like that they rolled deep and were in this horrible territory, killing Dracula's assistants,
gypsies,
and going after like the main vampire. Like these guys, I was all in on these guys. I'm like, these dudes are badasses.
If they weren't racing the sun with the visual of racing the sun, I think I would have had trouble engaging with it.
Yeah, I mean, that was all on stage, so they couldn't do too much of a chase. But I don't know, man. When I was younger, I remember it being much more intense. But I don't know, man. I just like that. You know me. I like it when people are up against something bigger than them. But there's actual odds. They're not superheroes. Like 13 Assassins, 13th Warrior, Magnificent Seven. I like when humans are actually in battle or the raid. I don't know. I like stakes. And I felt like there were stakes at this. And I felt it was necessary.
Like stakes to the heart.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Or like a steak. What movies feature? Or like a steak hand from Pain and Gain, like The Rock cooking it. But I don't know. I was all in. I was all in on this moment.
So Dracula is getting out of the coach. They get back to, you know, his castle. And there's that conflict where they cut his throat and they stab him through. And and our Texan is dying, and Keanu actually like holds everyone off from following them into the cave, him and his now love Mina, Winona Ryder. And Keanu's like, no, you know, it was almost like saying he's her problem now.
Yeah.
I don't remember the exact line, like he's hers to something or other to deal with.
I don't know why that happened.
Yeah, because then they didn't ensure, like, they don't know that he's going to die. Maybe they assumed he's going to die. But, you know, they let that happen, and she's desperately defending, and there was, you know, that kind of romantical polarity statement of, you know, is this what you do to me, Mina says, if, you know, when I kind of fully transition into a vampire. And then she gets in, she takes him to the original altar where we start the movie.
Yeah.
And she finishes him and
chops his head off.
Yeah. Well, first she pushes him, rams him through all the way with that huge Bowie knife, and then takes off his head. But before she takes off his head, there was almost like, it looks like Coppola was trying to depict an angelic atonement of this evil creature who rediscovered love.
Yeah, something like that.
It's like it showed the light coming down. It showed his face before he corrupted himself. He's there with his love. He actually asks her to give him peace. And it was almost like we were offering, instead of vanquishing this evil, we were instead, it struck me as we're giving forgiveness to this. And this creature is finding relief. I liked the scene, but now that I look back at it, once the movie was long over, I found myself wondering, like, is that the appropriate ending to a Dracula movie?
I didn't even think about that. I think I was so tired by the end of it. I was just so beat, I didn't really even think about that scene too much.
So if this movie was a horror movie, and I think it's many movies, right? But if this movie was a horror movie, I'd say you didn't end that horror movie well. But with this being such a romantic and fantastic movie as well, it actually makes it seem appropriate to me. Because again, this was as much a horror as it was a romance, and then equally a fantasy movie. You know, it's funny. I actually found myself a couple times with the visuals and some of the dancing scene that Dracula briefly had with Mina. I even thought of things like Labyrinth and Legend, the dancing scenes in those. I feel like that must have been in Coppola's mind when he had that little scene. But again, so it's like these fantasy components felt very strong to me. I really appreciated them.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of fantasy. This is a hybrid Bram Stoker's Dracula. It's faithful, but it's also very much in Coppola's brain. So I do think he added a touch of a little bit of everything in here. There's definitely a kitchen sink aspect to it.
I like his kitchen sink, I'm going to tell you. I do appreciate his kitchen sink.
So we had a few more questions, right? About this?
We do. We have a couple more. You know, we have a first-time questioner from Twitter. I like this play on words because I like the Hellraiser movies. But at the Cinnabite, the Cinnabite, he asks, or she, I'm not sure, do you think this film is overrated or underrated, and why?
All right, so it has a positive rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It made a lot of money. It made probably, you know, 140 million R-rated.
In the early 90s?
It made 80, then you just add inflation onto that, so let's say 140. It won several Oscars, so I don't think it's underrated or overrated, but I also think it's underlooked in regards to its overall ambition and set design. People don't really talk about this movie much.
Mm-hmm.
So it was successful and it won awards, but right now I think, you know what though? I've heard a lot of people rallying around this movie. It's film lovers love this movie. General assessment. I think if you're in a film and I remember my cousin Terry loved this movie. Or no, my step half aunt loved this movie. I don't know. That's a random aside, but I guess if someone said, Mark, overrated or underrated, I would say it leans more towards underrated.
I really want to agree with you. I'm going to go a totally different direction with this. A lot of times I've seen a movie that I didn't really like or appreciate personally, and sometimes they're kind of deep movies. And there have been times where someone has literally commented on our website on my review and said, you didn't get it. And now I'm not telling people who didn't like Bram Stoker's Dracula that they didn't get it. But I'm just saying that it's possible that you were watching this as a horror movie and judging it as a horror movie. And I think that it's like there are a lot of times when I walk into a movie expecting a certain kind of thing and it affects my whole thought process about it. And this time I knew I had seen it a dozen times and yet I totally forgot a lot of it. And I just was totally, I don't know, open yet excited to see it. I feel like there's a lot in this movie, and it's if you're not sitting there specifically with a ticket for this ride instead of just I'm going to watch a movie, I think that there's a lot to be missed. And I think it's easy to focus on a bad accent or some poor breaks in continuity between scenes or the breastiness of some of these scenes. You know, I think it's easy for something there to take an errant viewer out of the movie. And I think that can violate their enjoyment of the movie. I don't know. So again, I'm not saying that it's not like they didn't get it, but I think that there's a lot here. This is one of those movies where I'd say, please watch it again.
Would you recommend this movie to a lot of people?
I absolutely would. I think that the star power gives me the power to recommend it and get people to watch it. Now, how they're going to react, I'm going to be hopeful, but
I guess just the way they watch it. Like, oh, hey, I got some time on an airplane, or I have, like, if you watch this movie in the wrong circumstances, I could see you not enjoying it at all.
If you watch this on an airplane and once every 20 or 30 minutes you are distracted for even 5 seconds, I think that it's going to have a significantly negative impact. Whereas if that same thing happened to you watching the Ace Ventura, you enjoy it just as much.
Or like Kong Skull Island or something.
Or Kong Skull. No, yeah.
That's an airplane movie right there.
Well, honestly, in I thought it was vastly superior, but the 2006 King Kong, I think that it's okay if you're occasionally distracted from that.
I didn't finish the latest King Kong. I watched it again, like in about 8 different increments, but I didn't want to watch the ending because I was like, I like this monkey.
Yeah, I do think this is underrated. All the times I've ever heard anyone talk about this, and it's not that I'm proud that I said it out loud. I'm sure I'm not the only one, but I don't hear other people saying, likening it to a fantasy movie. I don't hear other people likening it to a romance. I think that they're going to call it a horror movie that happens to have a love story. I think that they're going to say, and I don't see people talking about fantasy. We are, but that's not something that I've heard at least enough for that to stick. If you say, hey, did you see Bram Stoker's Dracula? No, I don't really like horror movies. You know, that's the kind of answer you might get.
Yeah. You know what's kind of random? I know this is a little off topic, but there's a podcast called The Only Podcast About Movies, and they reached out to me about like the year end stuff and everything. I was like, well, I can't join you guys.
Because you're the only podcast about movies.
Yeah. And like, I think that's pretty funny. And really, really cool guys. And I was like, yeah, we're doing Bram Stoker. And the guy sent me like 8 different links of, you know, he compared the Dracula's armor to the Praetorian Guard from Last Jedi, the score. So I guess there are people. Do cinephiles really love this movie?
You know, I don't know. You know, until the last couple weeks when I started paying attention to it, I was under the impression that this movie was just generally loved. Yeah. And then I knew we were going to do it and I hadn't seen it in forever, I started paying a little attention. When I watch a movie, I post on Facebook that I'm watching the movie. Even a comment that I got from a close family friend who is quite a movie fan as well, commented that it was just terrible, that it was just a disillusioned train wreck. And then someone else jumped in and said that they thought it was equal parts art and hubris. And I see hubris there, but not in a way I don't like. But again, these are like good friends of mine who love a lot of the things that I love. And we are like fellow geeky people who embrace movies for what they are. And I'm seeing these opinions out there and I'm a little surprised. And then Twitter, there's another rabbit hole of possible opinions. And most of the people who bother to comment like it. But some people say, you know, yeah, like overrated.
Keanu Reeves.
Overrated. Keanu Reeves.
Everyone talks about Keanu.
Keanu Reeves. And I don't think that was what Alex Vorkov was saying per se, but he wasn't the only one to chime in. I got a personal message on Twitter about it just from someone who I knew. And, you know, it's interesting that I thought that this was such a – I thought that this was like the Interview with a Vampire, well, which I also assume is very well liked. But, you know, like I thought this was like that. I thought that there weren't really haters or general dislikers or negative critics of this movie. And it turns out that there are, and I was surprised.
Yeah.
And because of that, that makes me – and I thought that I was very fairly considering this a generally loved movie. It makes me want to lean towards underrated.
Yeah, I would lean towards that.
Definitely. You know what else? We've raved about it for 90 minutes, and we point out flaws. We just point out that we forgive them.
Yeah.
We point out loads of flaws. It's just that we forgive them all. And I point out a lot of flaws in a lot of movies. And, Mark, you know, I'm a less forgiving person, I think, than you are in a lot of our discussions. Because you have a closer filmmaking side perception of things, and I have a more, I don't know, like a passerby critic side to it that's maybe a little less forgiving or thoughtful on the first go. So, you know, even with that mindset, I have nothing but sympathy for this movie. I love this movie. This, and it's exhausting to watch, kind of like you said, and yet I watched it 2 days in a row and was thrilled to watch it 2 days in a row. I wanted to watch it today before we podcasted, and I just didn't have the time. Now, that's not to say that I do that 2 years in a row where I watch it 3 days in a row. It's been a while. I'm kind of taking it all in. It's a lot to process.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and maybe this is something that someone could say is a flaw of the movie, but I don't think that watching this movie once, no matter how thoughtful, is enough to properly judge it. That is equally a flaw in the movie and a defensive criticism of the movie at the same time for me. There's a lot here.
Oh, I do like the idea that it's art and hubris, because it's hubris that made this.
You know who said that to me on Facebook?
Who?
Dirty D.
Dirty D.
Dylan from Australia.
Poor Dylan. I like this next question.
So next question comes from return questioner, the Schlocker Knot. They have their own podcast as well. They ask, of all the camera techniques utilized in the movie, which was your favorite and why?
Oh, gosh, there's so much. I like the double expose, the way that they, you know, they shoot the mist as an element on itself, and then they put the film in a refrigerator, then they shoot the next element on it. I love just all, like, the different Dutch angles that they shoot, putting you off guard. I liked the usage of just, all the front projection, rear projection, rotoscoping. I mean, this movie, all right, but we have to pick a favorite, right? I like when they reversed, who's the lady that gets put in the coffin?
Lucy.
They did, like, the reverse of her. They, like, they had her getting out of the coffin, and they kind of, like, reversed it to her. So they had her get out of the coffin, and then, but then they reversed it and had her get into the coffin to add.
Oh, like, right. When Van Helsing was putting the crucifix at her.
Yeah. I mean, I like that a lot. I love that. I love the way they did it. That just really freaked me out. So I think that's probably my favorite shot.
And then she did a Sam Raimi projectile vomit.
That's right.
Van Helsing.
gosh, I like all the silhouettes. I like a lot of the crane movement to get Keanu. Oh gosh, this movie's chock full. But I love this, the how they reverse the footage. I thought that was beautiful to look at. So I'll say that.
For mine, they were like the kind of transitioning clip scenes. Like again, that introductory Kubo and the Two Strings. It had the silhouettes of the actual warriors, and then it had these paper cutouts in the background, which I assume were done in two different shots.
Yep.
That were overlaid. And then similarly, although a different way, when they layered the letter writing with the train going to Transylvania with Dracula's eyes in the backgrounds, those kind of, again, these very, to me, these fantastical overlays, these kind of epic journey feelings come when you show that stuff. So I really like that. I like those flavorful things. I think that without those two scenes and without the kind of that Indiana Jones map scene before that leads into the coach chase at the end, I think that these scenes, I don't know, they totally change the atmosphere of the film. It takes it a little away from horror again. It puts it into fantasy, or puts it into something more fabled.
Yeah.
And I again, and they might not be the most technical things. Obviously, doing it well is a technical victory. But the acts themselves might not be so impressive. But the fact that they were chosen in those scenes to be done in those ways, I really appreciated that a lot. Those scenes really – I can visualize those scenes perfectly in my head. I love them.
Yeah. I've watched so many movies that I've forgotten about. I've probably forgotten more about movies than I've watched, but I remember more of this movie, and I hadn't watched it probably since I was 11. So that really says something about this. And also it's called Reverse Motion. So and also the front projection is pretty great, how they kind of film something, and then they put people over it. I don't know. Coppola fired his entire visual effects team and hired his 29-year-old son, and it paid off.
He done good.
He done good. You got any plugs?
Lots of plugs. You know, with a lot of participation comes a lot of plugs. For their continued support, I'd like to offer our kindest shout-outs to Johnny Numb and Crash Palace from the Last Knock podcast. Real Jilly G from Twitter. She has her website, Crimson Quintessence. She's a big supporter of us on Twitter and occasionally on Facebook. A Fiend on Film through Twitter and Facebook. He has his own horror zine that he occasionally does. His new issue just came out. It's a tribute to David Cronenberg. Ooh. It's called House of Skin, and really? one of my articles is in it. And he sent me a hard copy of it. It's actually pretty cool. But again, you can download that for free if you go to the magnificent world of DaveK.wordpress.com. He has it there. Nice guy. He's always sharing our podcast on Facebook. Beyond the Void podcast, that's at BTVcast. You can find them on iTunes as well. They gave us some questions before. They just did their episode on the Velcro experiment and mayhem. We had a funny exchange with them, mostly you did, I think, on Twitter before either of our groups had recorded our podcast. And they gave us a listener question, which we answered. And they said that they'd answer the same question in kind. And I was listening to their episode today, and they, in fact, did. And during their podcast, they brought up their interactions on Twitter with you, listening to their discussions about the podcast, the listener question. I felt like they gave us three different plugs over the course of 30 minutes. They're really nice folks. I think they're going to become a new nice friend of the pod. I think that their episode was called Corporate Horror Part 2. I don't think they called it Office Horror. They did a whole part one, though, that I haven't even heard.
Oh, Jesus.
I'm curious to hear what their other takes on Office Horror were. And then, of course, for contributing listener questions, we got to say thanks to Neil from Greenville, the Horror Movie Podcast, and then on Twitter, YoungGhoul94, The Fear Merchant, Alex Vorkov, Slasher Trash, The Cinebite, and the Schlock or Not Podcast. All wonderful people who give us these great questions, or they add commentary that make us think about things in slightly different ways. Please keep giving us your listener questions. We love answering them, and we love going back and forth with you guys about these movies. Mark, you probably have something to say, and you should also let people know what we're going to be talking about next week.
Yeah, so I'd like to thank the Only Podcast About Movies, really nice guys. They actually learned about me from Reddit, and they asked me to be a guest on their pod so I could basically share all my stupid data about 2017. So that was really cool, man. Like, really good guys, good podcast, good product. So if you check out the Only Podcast About Movies, and then also check out Robert Lamb. He has a bunch of podcasts. We actually were part of the podcasting group with him, Seven Lambs, on Blog Talk Radio. Also, please rate, review, and subscribe. Please subscribe to the pod. That would be amazing. And next week, we are going to be covering Happy Death Day, PG-13 horror, and movies that repeat themselves. So we got Edge of Tomorrow, Groundhog Day, a movie I worked on called Prematura, which is on Netflix. So if you want to watch a movie that I worked on, it's a teenage sex comedy where a kid wakes up every night after – he wakes up in the morning after having a wet dream. Mom walks in on him every morning.
It's horrible.
And it has moments. Alan Tudyk's in it. But no, mainly we're going to talk about Happy Death Day. It's just a charming film. And if anything, I would watch it. It's good. It's breezy. It's fun.
I really like that movie.
It's fun. It's nice. Like it's a $5 million movie that does – exactly what it needs to do. So yeah, we're going to cover that. And also, guys, we know that you're busy. We know that there's thousands of podcasts. So, you know, from the bottom of our hearts, we're really appreciative that you're spending this time with us. You know, it means a lot. And if you ever have any questions, send them our way. And thank you, guys. So from me, Mark Hoffmeyer. And from John, Hard Rain, Black Rain, Purple Rain, Levengood. This is Movies, Films, and Flicks. See you next week.